coming up on Philosophy Talk.
I think it's important to be lucky in anything.
What's the difference between murder and attempted murder?
Well, the law treats attempted murder as less serious, so in a way you're lucky if you fail.
But if it's just luck, why do we punish one more than the other?
I think everybody's afraid to admit what a big part luck plays.
There's so much about my life that is beyond my control. I'm so lucky I didn't grow up in Nazi Germany.
To make room, you were picking women out and saying you and you and you have to be sent back to be killed.
Well, what would you have done?
Why do hard workers get so much praise when they were just lucky to be born that way?
It's not my fault that I was born lazy.
Lucky for you, I'm in a hurry, otherwise you would have been arrested.
We're up all night to the sun. We're up all night to get some. We're up all night for good fun. We're up all night to get lucky.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky?
Moral luck.
Well, do you, punk?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Ken teaches philosophy at Stanford. I teach philosophy at UC Riverside. But we both hang around Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, and that's where our conversations originate.
Today, we're talking about moral luck.
Well, Ken, let's start with the luck part. Suppose you and I both buy lottery tickets. You pick the winning number. I pick a losing number.
Lucky for me, John.
Now, think about how luck affects the identity of our actions.
You mean like whether we did the same thing or did different things?
Yeah. I mean, didn't we do different things? You picked the winning ticket. I picked the losing ticket. We had the same intentions with the same chances of success or failure, but we did different things.
No, luck doesn't affect the identity of our actions, John. It can affect the results of consequences of our action. I mean, our choices determine what we do, the identity of our action, but how our actions turn out, well, that, I agree with you, is a matter of luck. But actions are one thing, consequences are another.
Well, but you ought to admit that there's at least a sense in which we did different things. You did something important I didn't do. You picked the winning lottery ticket and you won the lottery. That makes our actions different.
No, John, that's only if you collapse the consequences or outcome in an action into the action itself. But we don't do that. The action is one thing. The consequence is another thing. The cause is one thing. The effect is something different. So why should we do that?
Well, we do it all the time. And we especially do it when it comes to things like ascribing legal liability, making moral evaluations punishing and praising.
But that just makes no sense, John. You know that old saying. I think you know it as well as anyone. Every gust of wind, every falling rock may affect what happens to me, but I alone determine what I do and what I deserve. Morality is about character, choices, and intentions. It's not about the vagaries of luck and circumstance.
Well, let's take a case. Imagine two doctors. They both administer a general anesthetic to a patient without checking to see whether the patient has epilepsy, which is a negligent thing to do. Case one, the patient happens not to be epileptic. The surgery goes smoothly. Case two, the patient is epileptic, has a seizure, and dies. The second doctor killed the patient. Do you think the doctors did the very same thing?
Yeah, I do think they did the very same thing. They both acted negligently in administering the anesthetic. That's what they did. Now, I do agree with you. The first doctor was just luckier than the second one in the outcome of the action, but they took the same action with different outcomes.
But do you really think they ought to be treated the same?
Why not?
Well, the law won't treat them the same. Under the law, the second doctor can be sued for medical malpractice and maybe even convicted of medical negligent homicide. Nothing remotely like that's going to happen to the first doctor.
Well, all that shows is that the law is philosophically confused. That wouldn't be the first time. It makes the unlucky doctor responsible for what happened as a consequence of his action, not for his responsible for the actions themselves. And then at the same time, the lucky doctor, who did exactly the same thing, gets off the hook entirely. It makes no sense, John.
Well, do you really think the unlucky doctor shouldn't be punished at all? Or do you really think that the lucky doctor should be punished equally with the unlucky doctor?
I think the law should treat like cases alike. That's what I think. The two doctors deserve the same treatment, whatever it is. There's no principled basis, no basis whatsoever for distinguishing what the one deserves from what the other deserves.
Well, you know, I'm not that interested in your kind of anal Kantian conception of moral desert. You're just kind of refusing to acknowledge a phenomenon that's quite real, moral luck. You're refusing to see that how society treats somebody has to depend on what they do in order for society to discourage people from taking that risk again.
John, you know, there's no principle here. There's no principled basis that could possibly be morally justified for distinguishing our two doctors. I just don't see a principle.
Well, you're just going to have to make a gestalt shift. Society has to set up a system of penalties that encourages people not to be negligent. And the way to do that is coming down terribly hard like a ton of bricks on people who are negligent where things go wrong.
No, I'm not sure I agree with you. Actually, I'm pretty sure I don't agree. I'm pretty sure it doesn't make any sense. But you know, it's an intriguing suggestion you made, and it's certainly one worth exploring in greater depth.
Well, with that high praise, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to test the intuitions of everyday people about the reality of moral luck. She files this report.
Let's imagine a man driving home late one night. He's a busy guy, a little irresponsible, and he hasn't gotten his brakes checked in a while. As he's pulling into his driveway, his brakes fail. He rolls to a stop, no harm done. The next day, he goes and gets his brakes fixed. Now imagine the same situation, only this time it's a woman, and her brakes fail at the precise moment when a kid runs into the street. The child is killed. So who's guiltier, the man or the woman?
They both essentially did the same thing, right?
Equally guilty, but bear different weight of responsibility because the outcomes were drastically different.
I don't think there's ill intent either way. I think it's just accidental negligence.
That's the sort of thing that you really beat yourself up about, is if something bad happens, then you're sort of like, I had the chance to fix this and I didn't.
She needs to be punished for the death of that person, or at least charged with involuntary manslaughter, not because she was morally wrong to not have her brakes checked, but because there's been a cost for somebody else.
I think having that experience is punishment enough. That's something you don't ever forget or forgive yourself.
Okay, let's kick this hypothetical situation up a notch. Now, instead of failing to get the brakes checked, let's say the guy is driving drunk. Also, let's pretend he's very wealthy and just 16 years old. How responsible is he then? This scenario actually played out in a Texas courtroom recently.
He got drunk, then jumped behind the wheel of his pickup truck and plowed down four people in a drunken haze. So why isn't Ethan Couch behind bars?
In one of the most bizarre defense strategies we've ever heard of, attorneys for Couch blame the boy's parents for his behavior that night, all because of how they raised him. A psychologist and defense witness testified that the boy suffered from something called affluenza, a lifestyle where wealth brought privilege and there were no consequences for bad behavior.
I think that he should be judged just as harshly as anyone else.
He should be tried as a minor, but I don't think he should have any leniency afforded to him because he's rich and his parents did a crappy job raising him.
I think driving drunk, whether or not you get lucky and don't kill people, or you do, that's way clearer to me.
Okay, now here's a different scenario. A woman has been wronged by her husband. She decides to kill him with poison, but she screws up the dosage and he lives. Down the street, a young man decides to rob a liquor store. He brings a gun just to threaten, but he ends up shooting and killing the clerk. Is the woman who tried to poison her husband less guilty than the armed robber?
Should there be a moral distinction between attempted murder and murder?
I mean, I think intent is very important to weigh in crime, and if the person was trying to kill her spouse or anyone and didn't succeed, it's basically a minor technicality that the person didn't die.
You can almost not make a moral judgment on what people's intentions are because we can only understand how things play out. That's the tricky thing, is that I think outcome always matters. You can sort of hypothesize or philosophize about what's more wrong or less wrong in the shades that go between that, but outcome does matter, because when you're talking about life and death and the world we live in, outcome matters.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about moral luck. Now, we're live on the radio right here, right now. We're not listening to the 49ers, and we know you aren't either. So we'd like to get lucky and have you join this conversation. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. We're joined now by Susan Wolf. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's author of Meaning in Life and Why It Matters. Susan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Hi, Susan. Let me ask you, why moral luck? Why that topic? Did you once avoid committing a really major sin because of lucky circumstances? Can you tell us more about that?
I think I've put that one out of my head completely. But I've been interested in moral luck, well, since I first heard the term, which came my first semester in graduate school when Thomas Nagel was trying to figure out how to talk about the term that was being coined during that semester by Bernard Williams. So for me, the first question that got me had to do with the fact that my parents were Jews growing up in Germany in the 20s and 30s. And so a lot of horrible things happened to them. They both obviously got out alive. But their attitudes to their fellow Germans, their Gentile fellow Germans, were so interesting to me. I mean, they weren't as judgmental. They didn't blame them as much as you might have expected them to. I think with this thought that, you know, anybody in those circumstances would, you know, maybe behave as badly as a lot of those people did, and had they, you know, grown up in the U.S., they wouldn't have done anything bad. So, I mean, that's a kind of moral luck that really struck me, got me thinking about.
So it sounds like your parents' attitude, which is kind of very sophisticated and admirable, is to not judge people so much for the consequences that they actually brought about because they were in terrible circumstances, but more for the internal qualities that in most circumstances wouldn't have those results. I mean, so they're kind of in a way skeptical about moral luck. I mean, about the idea that your morality really depends on luck. It should just depend on the inner qualities. Is that kind of your view, or do you think there is such a thing as moral luck?
Well, I think my parents, I think you're right. They had the right view about not taking just the consequences to be the indication of a person's moral qualities. But I think it's complicated. I think there is a phenomenon and that is appropriate and rational of people being angrier at people who've caused harm than people who, with equally faulty action, haven't caused harm. I think it's especially appropriate for a person to be angry with himself or to not angry is maybe not the right word, to feel horrible, like the doctor whose patient had epilepsy and died. It's appropriate that he feels way worse than the other doctor.
Well, Susan, really, do you just really briefly? I mean, we're going to dig into this, but shouldn't the guy who just got away with it, who was lucky not to, once he realizes the terrible risk, shouldn't he feel terrible too? Shouldn't the drunk driver who gets home safely without, shouldn't he feel terrible too? Because he took the same risk. I mean, you don't think there's anything to be said for the idea that the lucky person and the unlucky person should feel just as bad, should be condemned just the same way? Is there anything to be said for that, briefly?
Yes, there is something to be said for it. I mean, they were equally faulty, and in a certain way, I think they were equally blameworthy. But they did really different things. So I'm sort of agreeing with part of what John said and part of what you said earlier. And if you do something horrible, if you cause a horrible kind of damage, you ought to feel bad. And if you didn't cause damage, for you to feel as bad as the person who did would be crazy. You would think they would have some kind of complex.
Yeah, you know, so this is a complicated thing, and we're going to have to try and unravel some of the complexity. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking about moral luck with Susan Wolf from UNC Chapel Hill.
Murder is worse than attempted murder, isn't it? Or is it? Isn't it just a matter of luck? Does the whole idea of morality really make sense in this context?
Murder, attempted murder, and attempting to understand morality. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Got your cue on my insecurity, but I've been in the wrong place.
That's my namesake, Dr. John. Right place, wrong time. Is that all there is to moral luck? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking about moral luck, whether it's real and what it means.
Our guest is Susan Wolf, and she's the author of Meaning in Life and Why It Matters.
So, Susan, here are two plausible views that seem to me to have a great grip on common sense understanding of morality. I think it was illustrated by a roving philosophical report, actually. I mean, first intuition. What a person deserves, morally speaking, is a matter of their character, intentions, their motives, things like that. Not luck, not anything external to the agent. Second, compelling intuition. Killing is worse than simply being negligent. Murder is worse than attempted murder because the consequences matter to the, you know, the character of your actions. We got both these intuitions. Can they go together? It's not so obvious to me how they can go together.
Right. It's not obvious. I think the first intuition is very strong, and I agree with it. That is, well, you said it better than I won't even try to repeat it. But then, so now let's go to the second one. Is murder worse than attempted murder? Well, it's worse for some people, obviously, and for some purposes. But the paradox comes from the thought that it shows something worse about the murderer.
Right.
And I don't think it does. It doesn't show anything worse than about the murderer, since unless he attempted it once and then tried again and the other person. So what I think is mainly going on is, first, there's an action at, in which a person tries to do something, and two people might try to do something that's equally morally good or bad, morally wrongful or wonderful, and they deserve the same amount of praise or blame according to that. But then something happens. There's a consequence. It ends successfully or unsuccessfully. And then you're in the next moment, you're in a new situation. You have to deal with what's just happened. And if what's just happened is you've shot somebody, then you have to deal with that emotionally, practically, socially, legally. Whereas if what's just happened is, you know, a bird flew into the path, you killed the bird, not the person, and then you change your mind and think, you know, that was a lucky break, then you're in a totally different situation with a whole different set of things to deal with.
Let me give you an analogy maybe you and I are going to gang up against Ken, but that's not such a bad thing.
No, I can take it. I'm a big boy.
So two people are out hunting for mushrooms to eat, and they're both kind of stupid. They haven't really done the research to know which mushrooms are poisonous and which aren't. And the first person eats a mushroom without really knowing what they're doing, and they're fine because it's an edible mushroom. The second person eats a poison mushroom, and let's suppose he doesn't die, so we'll have him around to contemplate. But he goes through the agonies of Hades and you know, stomach's pumped, and he's in the hospital. Now, in some sense, they did the same thing. They negligently ate mushrooms. One of them did something the other one didn't do, namely ate a poisonous mushroom. That's the structure of action. You do one thing, and by doing it in circumstances, you do something else. Okay. Well, what's the big deal? Should the first person go through the agonies of hell when they didn't eat a poison mushroom just because the second person will because they did eat a poison mushroom? I mean, the structure of life is luck is involved in every sense. If you do different things, even if it's circumstantial, different results. Why should morality be any different?
Because, John, we think of moral responsibility as the stuff you do freely, voluntarily, the stuff that's within your control. We hold you responsible for the stuff that's within your control, not the stuff that's out of your control. And this luck element is pointing to the stuff that's outside of your control. So you would think might be morally irrelevant, but our intuitions won't let it be morally irrelevant. And I think we're incoherent because of it. What do you think, Susan?
Well, I think you're both right in a way. That is, the stuff that's in your control is relevant to how much how good or bad you should feel about yourself, how much people should blame you. So look, the guy who negligently ate mushrooms that might have turned out to be poisonous should feel bad that he was negligent. Negligence is wrong. You should not do it. And to take the reckless driver instead, he should feel very bad, also very lucky, but not as bad as someone who, doing something as wrong or as blameworthy, killed somebody. So on the one hand, I think it's not like you get off the hook completely if no harm comes of your somewhat wrongful action. And in the other direction, it's not as if you did a somewhat but not terribly wrongful action, you didn't get your brakes fixed within the first 2 weeks that you should have, it's not like drunk driving, much less like intentional homicide. Yeah. So that though you've done something that you should feel very bad about, it's not as bad as had you done something worse.
So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about moral luck, trying to make sense of moral luck. Kate from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Kate.
Hi. Love your show. My question is, or my comment is, maybe the reason why we treat attempted murder more lightly than, or attempted failures like that more lightly than we treat successful murder, is because we have a sneaking suspicion that the attempted murderer didn't try as hard as the successful one. I'll take my answer off the air.
So Kate's wondering that what do you think of Kate's suggestion, Susan?
I'm sure that's part of what's going on in many cases. But here's a case that I've heard of that I really like, about a person who plans to commit a murder, maybe to murder this guy in his sleep, gets the gun, shoots him through his heart. But it turns out he had died of a heart attack a half hour earlier. So she didn't commit murder, but that strikes me as, you know,
yeah, I tend
right
to,
up there with murder.
I tend to agree with you. I think a caller is psychologically right, but I mean in a lot of cases, but I'm not sure it explains our real dilemma. Here's an email from Paul, our old friend San Francisco. How can two distinct actions or events be the same if one act has a bad outcome and the other one doesn't? If one has a bad outcome and the other one does not, they cannot be the same. Now, let me just say a word or two about this. I think Paul is half right. I think the way we think about all these things that people do, there's a structure to it. If I drink coffee, I do that by moving the cup to my lips in the circumstance in which there's coffee in the cup. If I believe that that cup's full of coffee, I do so by being in a certain perceptual state directed at a certain cup. There's always circumstances involved. We can always back up to the non-circumstantial level, or we can include the circumstances. But our general tendency in human life, in individuating action, beliefs, is to take circumstances into account. So it'd be strange not to do it in the case of morality. So now I'm giving you this theory-laden email question, Susan.
Right. Well, I think you're right. I mean, we're performing in some ways one action, but we can describe it in 20 different ways, and some of them include the circumstances or the effects, and so they are the same action and they're not the same action according to your description of it.
But the question, okay, even if you were to grant John that, the question is which description of the action, the one that folds in the circumstances and the outcome, or the one that doesn't, is relevant to morality. I mean, a kind of Kantian way of thinking about this is that it's only the intention that matters. for the moral goodness or badness of the act, and not the consequences. Right. So,
but notice the intention itself is going to be circumstantial. Suppose a woman comes home with the intention of killing her husband, and she sees a guy out barbecuing, and she shoots the guy that's barbecuing, but it wasn't her husband. Did she have the intention to shoot the man who was barbecuing? Well, she had an intention to shoot the man she was seeing and aiming at, but she was wrong about who it was. So how are you going to describe her intention? That circumstances get mixed up in that. You can't just appeal to intention and get rid of circumstances, in my humble opinion.
What do you think, Susan?
Well, so I was actually going to go back to your earlier, the way you asked the question was, well, you know, what's relevant to morality?
Right.
And I think you were asked, you used that expression, but you had something much narrower in mind, which is sort of what's relevant to, well, maybe you can tell me, but it sounded like what's relevant to how much blame you deserve or how much punishment you deserve. If that was your question, then what I want to say is, okay. So I wanted to say what's relevant to morality is a much bigger question than that, because blame and punishment isn't all that's in question here, right? I mean, there's questions about how should he feel? How should we feel about him? What should he do next? All of which has a moral element to it. So I think actually the phenomenon, the paradox of moral luck is often a matter of thinking all of these things are supposed to line up with each other when they don't line up with each other. In terms of wrongfulness or faultiness, the consequences that are outside of our control don't affect that directly. But when we blame people or when we blame ourselves, that's not the only thing that matters. I mean, I just think we try to oversimplify too quickly when we decide either they deserve the same amount of blame or not the same amount.
Now both you and Ken are using this phrase, circumstances outside of our control. I think that's kind of misleading. Let's take two cases we've considered. Caitlin case a traditional case, you back over a toddler who's behind your car in the blind spot of your rearview mirror.
Right.
Now, that circumstance wasn't out of your control. You could have changed the circumstance. You could have moved the toddler. Compare that to the doctor case. He can't do anything about whether the patient has epilepsy. So I want to say that's an orthogonal issue, because moral luck of the sort we're looking at and whether something was out of your control, you couldn't do anything about it, those are different issues, in my humble opinion.
So what do you mean by luck, then?
Well, luck is, you in both cases, you're negligent. The doctor didn't check for epilepsy. The woman didn't check behind the car. Doing something about the circumstances that leads to the problem is a different issue. If she had discovered the circumstance, she could have done something about it. If he had discovered the circumstance, he couldn't have done anything about the circumstance. He would have just had to not do the operation with that anesthetic.
Well, so it just seems like we need to step back to find some more general description as to what counts. When we're talking about moral luck, I thought the idea is, look, there's a certain amount that we intuitively contribute to what we do in terms of intentions and choices and willing and deliberation. And then there's a certain amount that comes from other things, right?
I'm gonna raise a different issue, just really briefly, because you mentioned it in terms of your parents. And some people think there's lots of good. There's two of my favorite movies actually have moral luck at the center of them thematically. That's Woody Allen's Match Point and The Reader. They're both about moral luck. The Reader is about kind of what you talked about your parents. You're just an ordinary person in Nazi Germany. You have a character no different from the character of a person who grew up in an allied country on the good side, right? You have to find a job, you become a Nazi prison guard because there isn't much work in Nazi Germany after a while, you know. You become a Nazi prison, you take part in some horrible thing. If you had been in England, you wouldn't have taken place in that horrible thing. The person in England who didn't take place would have. Their character is no different from the person. Yet we judge the one, we say horrible, horrible, horrible. And we're not just talking about their actions, we're talking about their character. So right. you can be lucky, not just in the outcome of your actions, but in the circumstances in which your character is either put or not put to the test. And our moral intuitions are a little fuzzy about that, don't you think?
Yes, but this is another kind of case where I think don't try to oversimplify what, you know, that your reaction is either horrible, blameworthy, or you're okay, you're just one of us. You could say, look, I don't know whether you're horrible, but I can't deal with you given what you've done, right?
Right.
I mean, there are all kinds of negative moral, and these are moral reactions too. It's like, you know, don't expect me to treat you. I mean, let's just go back to the easier case for people who haven't seen or read The Reader anyway, of, you know, a slightly negligent driver runs over a child. Right? People drive that negligently all the time. Maybe she was reaching for her coffee cup when she shouldn't have been, or what. You know, we all do these things, and we get along with our neighbors who do them. We don't judge them, right? But now, let's say it was your child, and this slightly negligent driver ran over the child. I don't know. You might just think, I don't know whether to blame you. I don't want to even think about that. But don't expect me to be friends with you anymore.
Right.
Don't expect me to. You know, that's also a morally appropriate reaction, I think. And
well, I mentioned for our listeners that it's a hallmark of Susan's writing and thinking that she has a lot of examples, and she takes the she doesn't diminish the complexity of these things. And I think that's very good. I mean, in the case of running over the child. If a guy said, you know, well, I could have run over a child, but I didn't. I feel terrible. That's a good way for him to feel up to a point. If a person, on the other hand, runs over a child and says, well, you know, I ran over a child, but Jesus, I was just doing the same thing that thousands of people do every day. So why should I feel any worse than they do? It was just circumstances. We think that's really vile.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about moral luck with Susan Wolf from the UNC Chapel Hill.
If you and I are the same morally and equally blameworthy, doesn't it follow that we should be treated the same way in terms of punishment and praise?
The good, the bad, and the lucky. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Good versus bad. Just a matter of getting lucky. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Susan Wolf from UNC Chapel Hill, and we're talking about moral luck.
Susan, we've got an interesting email from Greg Slater, one of our old friends. He says, I just don't see how you would implement a system of justice in society that took complete account of luck. Just the problem of lack of information on what people get away with, what their motivations are. Such a system is just undoable. So if we were convinced that it's really unjust to punish people on the basis of circumstances rather than just kind of their internal morally relevant attributes.
Wouldn't work.
Would it work? Could we even do that? What do you think, Susan?
Well, I think the emailer is right. It would be impossible to do it perfectly, but we could do something in that direction. One thing that I'd heard considered about driving, for example, was that all reckless drivers, everybody who's caught driving recklessly, can be fined and put, you know, and the money can be put into a pool so that when an occasional reckless driver causes a lot of damage, instead of that particularly unlucky reckless driver having to pay all the damage, it gets paid from the pool that all the reckless drivers have contributed to. That's sort of a move in the direction of kind of evening out the cost of recklessness, you know, and mitigating the effects of luck.
Look, suppose somebody, some bright person in the California lottery, some philosopher that couldn't get a job teaching philosophy, so he's in charge of the lottery, says, look, I'm going to make this a lot more fair, right? Yeah. We're just going to take the winning and distribute it equally among all the people who bought tickets, because after all, they all exercise the same judgment. They're all, as far as we know, equally deserving. That would be a much more fair lottery. Of course, they
that
won't.
Wouldn't be a lottery.
They won't get quite as much as they put in because there's administrative costs. Well, that would destroy. I mean, nobody would. Now, isn't our system of justice a negative lottery? We say we don't want people to buy the negligence ticket that entitles them to a shot at being a negligent homicide perpetrator. So we make the cost of winning, that is to say, losing that lottery, as high as we can. Oh. Now, Susan's idea, Greg thinks is implausible. Let's distribute the costs among all the people who bought a ticket. That would really decrease the motivation that society provides for not driving negligently, because when it goes wrong, you wouldn't have these catastrophic
consequences. Wait a minute, Dan. You're going too fast for me. You're going too fast. The question, surely you don't think that if you're caught driving negligently, you should go unpunished because you didn't actually run anybody over, right? I mean, if you caught driving without your brakes checked, surely a reasonable system would you could be fined or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or if you're caught driving under the influence, you could be even if you know.
Well,
you know,
I mean, we have that system,
right. So now, if you increase the cost, right, so that it compensated for any possible harms that came through that whole district, that would make some sense, right?
Well, I don't think it would. Take that kid that ran over the four people with his truck because he was drunk and speeding. Suppose that four blocks up there was another kid driving a truck, equally drunk, equally speeding. He had an accident where he knocked down a pole, but he didn't kill anyone. If we take this system to its logical extreme, they'd be treated the same. Well, it's not clear to me that that would have as good a deterrent effect, which, of course, is a very controversial issue anyway, as the current system, where, well, you knocked on a pole, you were lucky. Look what happened to this kid four blocks down. He's in prison. Oh, wait, he's not, because he had affluenza. So I'm just not so sure that even if we could implement this thing, that if you take it too far, you're going to lose the deterrent effect of punishment.
You know, it seems to me like our total thinking about this is, as you like to put it, Susan, you were saying about the nuance and complexity and all that. But I think it's like a I don't know if it's nuanced and complex. I think it's just a hodgepodge. Half of our soul is consequentialist, where we think it's consequences that matter to the rightness and wrongness of an action. And half of our soul is Kantian. I think it's intentions that matter. And we have no really coherent, uniform reconciliation of these things. You know, I mean, I think people of good character are outstanding, but then turns out I don't really know what people's characters are, because I judge their character partly by how they behave in circumstances, but people aren't put in much different circumstances. And then we judge them by the circumstance and the character common, and we just don't know what the heck we're doing. I just think we're just confused. A hodgepodge of conflicting things. What do you think of that?
Well, I think we're less confused than you do, but that we do, you know, jump to conclusions. We want to make conclusions. We don't want to constantly get mired in nuances and say, I don't know all the details. I mean, we never know all the details. So we make judgments that sometimes are unjustified. And you know, we just have to live with realizing that, you know, often we're going to be over, you know, either judging people overly harshly or overly easily. But like, to take the case of the, you know, drunk driving, for example, somebody who drives drunk and hits a pole instead of a person, we might decide that that should be punished quite harshly, and harshly enough that you have pretty strong incentive not to do it, even without having to worry about the incentive to not kill anybody. I mean, because the risk is very great. And so, you know, it seems to me, thinking about the incentives here, it's not at all obvious that we do better by only punishing the ones who cause very bad harm. And it does seem to me more just to punish people more equally if, which is a big if, we can tell that they're equally negligent or reckless or faulty.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that it's not really, I mean, Ken is kind of right, but it's not really a hodgepodge. I mean, Susan's parents' reaction that she told us to the fact that the extreme circumstances of being a Gentile in Germany during the Holocaust aren't a very good guide to the differences in character that we ordinarily care about. I mean, psychologists tend to do these experiments where they show in extreme circumstances people will do really vile things to show that our concept of a character trait is no good, but it is good. It's very useful through a wide range of circumstances.
Well, that's what you think. A lot of psychologists like to say, I agree with you, it's not clear they have the right to say what they like to say, that there's no such thing as character.
Yeah, I think it's clear that they don't have the right. We have a good email here from Lucy in San Francisco.
It's on just this topic, right?
Which is kind of on just this topic. You've been talking about, she says, you've been talking about judging character over consequences of actions. But isn't one's character also a matter of luck? I mean, I'm lucky because, you know, I'm charming and witty. Ken is kind of gruff and, you know, but, you know, you shouldn't. Yeah, right. That's just luck, right?
I mean, especially if you think of you should be held responsible or evaluated on the basis of only things that are within your control. Is your character within your control? Why? I mean, any more than the consequences of your actions sometimes? What do you think about that, Susan?
Well, no, your character is not under your control to a large extent. It is a matter of luck to a large extent. I find it a lot easier to live with that than, that is, to just think, well, to think you are responsible for who you are, what you do, you know, what you value and how you behave with that, even though, of course, you didn't create yourself from nothing. I mean, who you are is a function of upbringing, background, and so on. But, it, you know, why doesn't that bother us so much?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I agree it doesn't bother me as much. But, you know, if you think about the totality of things, I don't make my character. I don't make many of the consequences of my action. Moreover, I also don't make what my character causes me to do. Like, if I'm lucky enough to be born on the right side of the war, my character will cause me to join the victorious side and blah, 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 and not do any. If I'm unlucky enough to be born on the wrong side of the divide, that very character will cause me to do what people regard as horrible things, and I'll be called a horrible person. Same character, different. And see, none of it seems...
You know, I don't actually know that I would accept that description. Right?
Okay.
When you talk about your character causing you to do these things, I don't really think it works that way. I mean, let's say I have an honest character. Does that cause me to tell the truth? I mean, I tell the truth. That's what you would expect of someone who's honest. But it's not as if honesty is a causal factor pushing me into truth telling.
Don't you think honesty answers the question? Look, why did he tell the Nazis where his mother? This is Kant. You can't lie even to the Nazi at the door. What caused him to tell the Nazi where his mother was hiding when the Nazis came to the door? Oh, he was scrupulously honest.
Well,
you don't
I,
think that you
can... No, I would say stupidity.
Yeah. But what caused him to tell his wife that dress looked horrible on her? His overvaluation of honesty. You don't think that's
well,
right?
His over-evaluation of honesty, that would be an answer. That's mm-hmm. not the same as saying, oh, because he has an honest character.
Yeah, an honest character is more kind of a uniformity rather than a particular cause. It's a pattern rather than a instance of the...
So would I say that... But you do think we judge people partly on the basis of their character, and people with the same character, if they're in different circumstances, we will judge them differently, and that's either luck or non-luck sometimes. You agree with that, don't you?
Sure.
How can you not? How can you not agree?
Well, Susan, on that note of agreement or disagreement or whatever, I'm going to thank you for joining us. This has been a very fortuitous conversation.
Lucky for me, too. Thank you.
Okay. Our guest has been Susan Wolfe. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's author of Meaning in Life and Why It Matters. So, John, what are you thinking today? You feeling lucky?
Oh, I don't know. I never feel all that unlucky. I mean, how can you when you've, you know, made it to 71 years old and you're not limping around and you're not senile yet. Did I mention I wasn't senile yet?
I'm wondering if you're feeling morally lucky or morally unlucky.
Yeah, I feel very morally lucky. I've done some really dumb things that in the wrong circumstances could have resulted in horrible things. And so far, knock on wood, I haven't really perpetrated any horrible crime or my negligence hasn't led to homicide. You know, I feel very morally lucky.
Only a true moral saint, something else Susan Wolfe has talked about a lot, could get by without moral luck. We all need a little moral luck. But, you know, this conversation continues over at Philosopher's Corner, our new blog on our community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our webpage, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from someone who runs right past any circumstances or issues of luck, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, let's say your vice principal brought you to his office when you were 16 and scolded you for not living up to your potential. You never got over it. Now you're all grown up, brooding and bitter, so you decide to take down the vice principal, now retired. You go back to your hometown, buy a rifle, take careful aim, and you miss? One could argue that this would-be shooter faces more contempt from society than if he'd made the shot. What kind of loser can't even kill his high school vice principal? On the other hand, missing is just a matter of luck. Whether that luck is bad or good depends on how evil one thinks the vice principal actually was. And really, no crime has been committed. I mean, I daydream about killing people 24/7. That makes me a person with a creepy inner life, but it doesn't make me evil. These sorts of issues may be fodder more for fiction plots than philosophical discussions. But maybe not. Now, say I want to punch Senator Ted Cruz in the nose, which I do, by the way. Does that make me a bad person or a good liberal? How about the guy I met at a party the other week? There was a buffet, and as I was helping myself, I said I was starving, and he said that was offensive to people who actually are starving. I wanted to punch him in the nose, too. No doubt all self-righteous prigs could use a good punch in the nose, but should I be the one to give it to them? Especially since there doesn't seem to be any kind of ideological coherence in my desire to punch. Does that even matter anymore, now that we have the internet? Teasing people on Facebook until they kill themselves, for instance, are teasers to blame? What if a person is teased relentlessly and that person doesn't kill himself? Who gets the credit for that? And, looking back, what about crimes that are only crimes if you find out they're crimes? Oedipus kills a guy, then marries his wife. If he'd never found out the guy was his dad and the widow his mom, what harm would have been done, really? We'd have lost a Greek tragedy and a Freudian trope, that's about it. What about the historical and literary links between irony and murder, like trying to poison your wife and poisoning yourself instead? Alfred Hitchcock and Twilight Zone episodes are built on these. And there's James Bond, of course. In the book, Dr. No had a front for his evil schemes as a miner of guano. At the end of the book, James Bond buries him in guano. That's irony, see? Wicked barber gets killed by a bag of hair. Truck driver gets run over by his own truck. Evil philosopher is killed when thought experiment goes horribly wrong. And country music is full of crimes that have an awful twist. There's a Mel Tillis song, for instance, called Veil of White Lace. The singer's been dumped for another guy, so he decides to go to the wedding and kill the bride. After the vows, he shoots her, then runs out of the church, only to see his former lover outside, alive. She'd decided not to get married after all. He'd killed the wrong woman. And if he'd listened to his vice principal in high school, maybe none of this would have happened. I hope we've all learned a valuable lesson here. I gotta go.
Death to a stranger, meet the veil of white lace.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks for thinking, too.
You're lucky. He's lucky. I'm lucky.